three questions I would really like to get through, because there are a lot of questions in that box that still need to be answered. And so I'm going to do two quick ones, and then we're going to try to get to the third one. And by the third one, I'll know how much time I have to cram it in to get it done. So here's the first question that was asked. Did King Saul kill himself, or did someone else do it? All right, good question. Did King Saul kill himself, or did someone else do it? And the reason for that question is if you look at 1 Samuel, if you turn there, if you have your Bibles with me, 1 Samuel chapter 31. Here we have the account of Saul's death. First Samuel chapter 31. Verse 4. Then Saul said to his armor bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through it, lest these uncircumcised come and thrust me through and mistreat me." But his armor bearer would not, for he feared greatly. Therefore Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. Right, so here we have Saul killed himself. Right, he fell upon his own sword. Now, maybe in most of your Bibles, flip over one page, 2 Samuel chapter 1. In the very beginning, verse 1, after the death of Saul, when David had returned from striking down the Amalekites, David remained 2 days in Ziklag. And on the third day, behold, a man came from Saul's camp with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. And when he came to David, he fell to the ground and paid homage. David said to him, "Where do you come from?" And he said to him, "I have escaped from the camp of Israel." And David said to him, "How did it go? Tell me." And he answered, "The people fled from battle, and also many of the people had fallen and are dead. And Saul and his son Jonathan are also dead." Then David said to the young man who told him, "How do you know that Saul and his son Jonathan are dead?" And the young man who told him said, "By chance I happened to be on Mount Gilboa, and there was Saul leaning on his spear, and behold, the chariots and the horsemen were close upon him. And when he looked behind him, he saw me. And he called to me, and I answered, 'Here I am.' And he said to me, 'Who are you?' And I answered him, 'I am an Amalekite.' And he said to me, 'Stand beside me and kill me, for anguish has seized me, and yet my life still lingers.' So I stood beside him and killed him, because I was sure that he could not live after he had fallen. And I took the crown that was on his head and the armlet that was on his arm, and I have brought them here to my Lord." Okay, so now we have two separate accounts. We have one that Saul killed himself. We have another account that this Amalekite ended up killing Saul after he had fallen upon his sword. And so the question is, which one is true? Or is there maybe a contradiction between the two? And what I would say is this. The Amalekite is not to be believed. The Amalekite is a liar. I think that's probably the case. That's what we have going on here. For a couple reasons. In verse 5 of 1 Samuel chapter 31, we're told, "And when his armor bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him." Okay, so the armor bearer waited long enough to see Saul no more life in him before he killed himself. Okay? So that this Amalekite, I'm sure, you know, he was there. Maybe he's seen Saul dead upon his sword, which is why he's able to come back and say that. But I think he was expecting a reward, right? He was expecting maybe to be honored by David for being the first one to come back and bring this news. And so that's why he brings it, and he embellishes the story, right? Lies, and says that it was actually him who dealt the last blow. In 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 10, I think David himself hits on this. 2 Samuel chapter 4, verse 10. "When one told me, 'Behold, Saul is dead,' and thought he was bringing good news, I seized him and killed him at Ziklag. which was the reward I gave him for his news. Okay, so ultimately Saul kills himself. The Amalekite account is a fabrication of the truth. This Amalekite comes to David thinking that he's going to be rewarded for the news that he's bringing them. And in fact, he was rewarded, wasn't he? But it was just not the reward he was looking for. It was death. Okay? So that answers first question. Second question. You mentioned that if the devil is not able to succeed in tempting us to sin, then he will use fear and pain, etc., to get us to turn from God. If we do not verbalize our fears, does he know them in our own thoughts? Does he possess the ability to know our thoughts? Okay, second question. So, the short answer is no. Right, he doesn't have the ability to know our thoughts. That ability belongs only to God, right, and God alone. He is infinite. He is omniscient. Remember that Satan is just an angel, right, in a fallen, right, bad angel, but he's an angel. And so angels are finite. If a creature is finite, they have limits. And so there's a limit to Satan's knowledge, right? He cannot know our thoughts. Even when we think about angels' knowledge, there's kind of, it can be broken down in four ways. Angels have natural knowledge, right? That which they had by nature as they were created. They have revealed knowledge, right? Whatever it is that that God revealed to them, they have acquired knowledge. We're told, right, the angels rejoice when a sinner is saved, right? So they now acquire this knowledge of the sinner saved and is able to rejoice. And then they have supernatural knowledge, which would be because of the accomplishment of what Christ did on the cross. Although he did not, right, redeem angels, he did confirm them in their state so that they would know now that they cannot fall, right? And they cleave and hold on to God. So those are the four kinds of knowledge that angels have. And so, right, one is not omniscience. That belongs only to God. We can look at a text like Psalm 139, verses 1 and 2. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and I rise up. You discern my thoughts from afar. Okay, so that type of infinite knowledge, the knowledge of even the thoughts of man, belongs only to God. But just because Satan doesn't know your thoughts and can't get into your head, doesn't mean that he, in a sense, doesn't know what we're thinking or know what our weaknesses are. Remember that Satan, although a created being, is in the category above human beings. Right? He is pure spirit, as all angels are, and so if man knows themselves, it would make sense that the angel who is of a higher order than man would know that which is lower than him. Right? He would know something about those who are created and under the angels. Also, remember that Satan himself, most people assume, right, the sin was pride that cast him down out of heaven. So if Satan himself deals with pride, right, that it would be, I think, a fair conclusion to draw that he would understand that these types of sins even humanity deals with. Think about also, Satan is a master watcher. And so he doesn't need to get into your head to know what you're thinking, know what your fears are. He sees it play out every day in your lives. And he pounces upon those chances, and he does that. And he's been doing that for thousands of years, right? He's crafty, and he's cunning, and he knows what he's doing because he's been doing it for so long. And so, I don't think it's a good thing then to, like, hold in your fears and don't say them for, because you're afraid maybe Satan will then know what your fears are, play upon them. Ultimately God calls us, doesn't he, to cry out to him, to voice our fears and concerns, our anguish, our worry. Ultimately trusting that God's will is always going to be done, right? That Satan cannot touch us unless God allows it to happen, unless it be God's will. And so we just have to, right, trust and rely in God and his goodness over his creation. So that's the answer to the second question. making pretty good time here, so I got 15 minutes now to deal with the bigger question that we started to touch on last time, but had nowhere near enough time to do it. So that question, if you remember, was, who are the Nephilim? Okay, who are the Nephilim? And remember, we said there are there are two kind of major views. There are others. We don't want to get into them all. And even these views aren't kind of monolithic. They can take some different shapes and forms and varieties. But generally speaking, these are the two major views, right? The Sethite view and the angelic view. And we get, let's turn in our Bibles to Genesis 6, though, so we can just look at the passage real quick before we deal with it. Genesis chapter 6, verse 1. When man began to multiply in the face of the land, and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives any they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not abide in man forever, for he is flesh. His days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of man, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, the men of renown." Okay, so that's kind of the text in question. And from that text, what we generally see are these two views, the two major views, the Sethite view and the angelic view. So we're just going to briefly go over both of them, tell you which one I hold, and tell you why I think the other one's not a good option. Okay. So first, with the Sethite view, what do we see going on here leading up to chapter 6? Right? Context is important for understanding. And so what we see is, after the fall, starting in chapter 4, running to the end of chapter 5, two lines are being traced. One of Cain from Genesis 4, 1 to 24, and one from Seth, chapter 4, verse 25 to 5, verse 32. So you have these two lineages being mentioned here. And Seth actually begins to, we're told, call upon the name of the Lord. And then all of a sudden, in chapter 6, you have these two groups now that are being dealt with. And so the context seems to lend itself more to these being human beings first and not angels. Because angels, where do they appear from, right? They're not in the context of this of the passage. And what came just before it. And so that's one reason why the Sethite view is prominent. Also, what we need to see is there's a correlation, I think, here. Genesis chapter 3, verse 6, with Eve. "So when the woman saw that the tree was good for food and that it was a delight to the eyes, and the tree was to be desired to make one wise, she took of its fruit and ate." And that's the same thing that we see going on here. In Genesis chapter 6, verse 2, "The sons of God saw that the daughters of man were attractive, and they took as their wives." And so what do we see? We see this the same pattern of Eve, the same pattern of sin, of seeing and taking, continue after the fall. And this is why one of the reasons why God is so angered with man, because they continue to rebel against him. Right? They didn't learn from Eve. They continue to follow the pattern of Eve. And just as man was punished when Eve sinned against God, so too man is, what we're told, is punished in their sin against God here, which is why he floods the earth. And we're told that in verse 5, "The Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and every intention of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. The Lord regretted that he made man on the earth, and it grieved his heart." Right? "I'm going to blot out man," he says. And so It's men, we're told, who sinned against God, not fallen angels. It says nothing here about fallen angels. And so with respect to then, who are the Nephilim? Well, the sons of God are the line of Seth. The daughters of man were attractive, the line of Cain. And so, right, the sin they commit is being unequally yoked, right? The godly line of Seth, going outside of that line, marrying the ungodly line of Cain. But now, who are the Nephilim? Do the Nephilim even come from these two lines? And the answer is no. Right? Verse 4, the Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward. Right? They were already there, Scripture tells us. So they were not a production of these two groups coming together. But rather, they were there. And that makes all the more sense, right? That these are just normal people, because if you look later in the book of Numbers, chapter 13, verse 33, what do we see? We see Nephilim again. Right? We see Nephilim, chapter Numbers 13, verse 33. And there we saw the Nephilim, the sons of Anak, who come from the Nephilim. And we seem to ourselves like grasshoppers, and so we seem to them. Right? So these are just mighty men. Right? Strong warriors who are of old, the men of renown, they're called famous men. Warriors, certainly big, but what was their sin? Why are they mentioned here? Well, because they used that mighty prowess they had to inflict violence upon the earth. And I think we see this being one of the reasons for the flood. If you look at Genesis chapter 6, verse 11, now the earth was corrupt in God's sight, and the earth was filled with violence. And God saw the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way on the earth. In verse 13, and God said to Noah, I have determined to make an end to all flesh, for the earth is filled with violence through them. And so I think, right, that's a reference, right? Not only the corruption of all the earth with the sons of God marrying the daughters of men, but also he's flooding the earth because of violence, right? Because of the Nephilim, because of what the sin that they committed. And so that's why both of those are mentioned here. That's why we find the Nephilim in chapter 6, verses 1 to 4, because they are part of the problem as well. Right? It wasn't just that the sons of God married the daughters of men, but it was also, there was all sorts of sin, all sorts of corruption happening. Right? Not just sexual or even religious in marrying and being unequally yoked, but also violence. And so that would be the Sethite view. The angelic view would be obviously that these sons of God would be angels who came down and intermarried with human women. Now the major kind of argument for this position comes from the book of Job. Right in the opening chapters of the book of Job, we see that title sons of God being used of angels. And so this is why many believe that the sons of God reference here is then to angels. In Job chapter 1, verse 6, now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came along with them. Job chapter 2, verse 1, again, there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came with them to present himself before the Lord. And so they say that these angels come down, they marry regular women, and they produce the Nephilim. Right? So they would see the Nephilim as a product of that union. So that the Nephilim are, you know, giant warrior, you know, super half, you know, half superhuman, half regular kind of person. But I don't think that works quite well. You know, there's so many, I think, issues that plague that. First, it's a contextual issue. Right? There's nothing about angels here being spoken about. It's all about men. It's not angels who are being punished for the sin. It's men who are being punished. We have to think of why then Numbers 13:33, are there Nephilim again? If God destroyed everything in the earth and only allowed eight men to live, how did these Nephilim continue to exist? Also, we have to think about this. And I think that this is probably the strongest argument for why it can't be angels. Okay, and it's twofold. First is, remember what angels are. Angels are, they're pure spirits. And so there are some sins angels cannot commit. No angel can commit the sin of gluttony. They don't have bodies. They don't need to eat. They don't become hungry. No digestive system, any of that. Right? There are certain bodily sins that we commit because we have bodies. They are incorporeal. They don't have bodies. And so there are certain sins of the sensual appetite that they cannot commit. Which means what? Ultimately, angels cannot commit sexual sin because they don't have a sexual appetite. They're spirits. They don't have bodies. Right? Angels don't have a sexual appetite. And so, right, what's the sin? These people, the sons of God here, what are we told? They saw the daughters of man were attractive. They took him as their wife. It was lust, right, that was behind this. Well, angels don't have lust in that way. They don't have lust for a woman. They don't have lust for sexual intercourse. Right? That's not, they can't even do it. Right? Also, here's in conjunction with that one. Angels cannot produce substances as pure spirits. There are two types of, or two modes of production. Creation and generation. Right? Creation and generation. And angels can't do either. Can angels create? Absolutely not. That's only infinite power is able to create something from nothing. So they don't have that. Neither, though, do they have generation. Right? Jesus says, what about the angels in Matthew chapter 22, verse 30? Or what about us? Right? That in heaven we're going to be like the angels who neither marry nor are given in marriage. Why is that? Well, because they have no sexual appetite. They're spirits. They don't have physical flesh and blood like you and I have. They don't have that desire. They don't have that appetite. They don't have that yearning. They don't have that wanting. That's why neither will we when we're in heaven. We're going to be like them. For they neither marry or are given in marriage. Well, what's the context here in Genesis chapter 6? They marry. Now you say, well, they kind of took on a human body and did this. Well, then what we're talking about is human DNA and human DNA, which would have made a human being, not a superman. It still would have been a human and a human, which equals human. There's a pure spirit has nothing material to give, to provide in the procreation of a child. And so I think those are the strongest reasons, those two. Right, that they have no ability to create or generate, and also as pure spirits, they don't have certain appetites like you and I have. Right, they don't have a sensual appetite. They don't have sexual appetite. They don't have those same desires that you and I have, which is all the more reason, I think, to understand this passage, not just contextually, but just based on metaphysically, what can actually happen and what can be done. And then lastly, not to sway anybody or make anybody feel bad if you don't hold this position, but I'm just gonna leave off with a quote from Calvin, and I think it kind of nicely buttons up our discussion for this morning. Okay, Calvin says this in his commentary on Genesis chapter 6. That ancient figment concerning the intercourse of angels with women is abundantly refuted by its own absurdity. And it is surprising that learned men should formerly have been fascinated by raving so gross and prodigious.